Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
Hello, hello, hello. It is another episode of the Council of Trent. I am your host, Trent Horn, Catholic apologist and speaker. Today, we're going to be talking about a study you may have heard about in the news, published by Lisa Littman. It's published in the Plus One Journal, PLOSONE, and it is about rapid onset gender dysphoria. And if you're not hip to the lingo, if you've heard of being transgender or what used to be called transsexual, the term that is now preferred that you'll find, for example, in the DSM-5, the Diagnostic and Statistics Manual for what psychologists use to diagnose mental disorders, in that diagnostic manual, it used to say, until a few years ago, it used to have something called gender identity disorder, which is the idea that you, if you are a man who thinks he is a woman or a woman who thinks she is a man, you have an identity disorder. That has been removed, though, without any kind of scientific experiments or analysis to justify that. Instead, the term has been replaced with gender dysphoria. And so the idea behind gender dysphoria is that your mental illness or your negative condition, no, they don't even want to say you have a mental illness here, that the condition you have that is causing you problems is just feeling uncomfortable or having a sense of discomfort with your biological sex and the gender with which that you identify. And in many cases, the treatment, in quotes, to help relieve this dysphoria is to not use therapy to help a person come to terms with the actual sex that they are, but to use hormones, to use surgery, to use other things to try to make their body and their appearance conform to their sense of gender identity. And what you'll hear about, you know, in radio and in news, when people talk about transgender identity, you'll hear all of these stories from people who've said, you know, I've always felt this way. You know, this is very similar to when people were debating the issue of homosexuality. It's not even the word that I really like using, because I don't believe there are heterosexuals or homosexuals. I believe there are people, men and women made in the image of God, who have different kinds of attractions, some transitory, some deep-seated, some to the opposite sex, some to the same sex. But when people were debating same-sex issues in the 90s, that's when we, you know, even earlier in the 80s and things like that, you're hearing the slogans like, I was born this way, I didn't choose this, this is who I am, I've always felt this way, which I always thought was just kind of odd. You know, when people say, you know, I was born this way, I've always felt attracted to people of the same sex, because I could remember being 6 or 7 years old myself and most other elementary school age children and not being attracted to any members of either the opposite sex or the same sex, because normally you don't have sexual attraction to other individuals until you reach puberty. So I always thought that was just kind of a weird way to describe it. I think what people mean is, as long as they can remember their sexual attractions, it has been to, you know, just to a particular sex. It's not something that they chose. I didn't choose this. So you have to respect this is just a part of who I am. Now, one, even if that were the case, you can be born with or develop early in life attractions, different parts of your person that could be disordered. Just because a person has had a disordered sense of self for a very long time, that doesn't justify it. I mean, somebody could say, why are you mad at me for having a short temper and losing my patience? I've always felt this way. Even since I was a little toddler, I, you know, had a short temper and I would always lash out at other people. That's just who I am. Maybe it is who you are, but it doesn't mean it's who you have to be. You don't have to be defined by your impulses, your attractions, or other things like that. So we see that a lot with same-sex issues. And this is coming over also into the transgender issue. When you look on news reports, news magazines, they'll tell stories about people who said, I knew ever since I was 3 or 4 years old that I was a woman, not really a man, or I was a man, I'm not really a woman. You know, I was 3 and I told my mommy I want to wear a dress. And mommy said, well, no, you're a boy. And, you know, that can get to say, oh, well, maybe this just is who this person really is. Now, of course, when you look at studies, that children who say that they belong to the other gender, and I also don't like that word either, because gender is a property of nouns. There is only the biological sexes, male, female, and the very small minority of cases of intersex where we have a difficult time discerning. But you'll have people say, well, no, I belong to the other sex. I'm female, and I've always felt this way. That when we actually follow these individuals, 80% of them grow out of this phase. 80% of them no longer identify that way, even if they identified as that way early on in childhood. When they reach puberty, because imagine saying, you know, oh, you have a five-year-old, a four-year-old, who identifies a boy who identifies as a girl, you know, I wonder what might happen after his body is flooded naturally with testosterone and is allowed to develop naturally what will happen. Why in the world would we invade this child's body, possibly amputate some of their body parts when you have something that is, in many cases, it's transitory, something that is grown out of? So what a recent paper that was published at Plus One, this is a peer-reviewed journal, and the person who authored is Lisa Littman. She is an assistant professor of the practice of behavior and social sciences in the Brown School of Public Health at Brown University, is actually looking at, hey, there's individuals who claim to have gender dysphoria, who claim to be transgender, who have not claimed this since they were three or four, who have not exhibited these behaviors at a very early age with their parents. And Littman calls this rapid onset gender dysphoria. And here, I'll just read the article at the Brown Daily Herald. This is what it says about it. On August 22nd, the university published a press release on the first ever research study to investigate rapid onset gender dysphoria. Littman's study proposed that online forums and social media have allowed transgender identities to spread among adolescents in a manner dubbed social contagion. Now, right there is where Littman's getting in trouble with people. Like, how dare you say this is a contagion? How dare you compare this to some kind of virus that's spreading? I'm sorry, this is a destructive sense of identity and self. It is harmful to the human person. And it is completely valid to study that this attitude may be contagious in the same way that suicide is contagious. It's well known that when someone engages in suicide or even promotes suicide, there is an uptick in suicides, that suicide can be contagious in people who imitate others that engage in it. That you would think, well, suicide is just something that if you're mentally ill or distressed, it's only going to affect you, it's not going to affect others. No, it can, even someone who would be relatively healthy, who wouldn't commit suicide, may be more tempted to commit suicide when they see someone that they respect or look up to commit suicide. That's why that hideous show on Netflix, 13 Reasons Why, you know, it's supposed to be a mystery about a girl who committed suicide. Studies have shown that when it's been aired, it's been watched, there was like a 20% increase in internet searches on the term how to kill yourself. So it is so irresponsible. The way many people, we should talk about suicide prevention, identification, but not do it in a way that glorifies the subject. You know, God help us. So this study by Littman was showing that, hey, there's individuals, teenagers, who identify as transgender very, very rapidly, that their parents, it just comes out of nowhere. And what Littman was trying to see is, well, where do these individuals, where does it come from? And she sees, you know, cases where it talks about how, oh, you know, they were really getting involved in things like social media, or if a friend identifies as having a transgender identity or gender dysphoria, then they're a certain percentage much more likely to identify. And there's all different kinds of stories. I've gone online and read lots of stories from parents who have teens that have this rapid onset dysphoria, and they talked about how they have always not felt comfortable in their own body, and then they just, you know, watch a ton of YouTube videos of transgender advocates who are growing a lot in popularity on the internet, watch them over and over and saying, yeah, that's my identity, that's who I am. And so Littman's study is trying to see, well, who are these individuals, what are they like? The ones who claim in their teens to be transgender very rapidly, what can we learn about this? And when the study was published, there was this huge public outcry online from people who defend transgender ideology, saying this is terrible, you know, this is transphobic, this is hateful. And so Brown University took down its press release advertising that the study had been published, the first of its kind. And so thankfully there are individuals who are even in favor of transgender ideology who see this as an attack on academic freedom. The former dean of the Harvard Medical School, Jeffrey Flyer, this is what he says. For centuries, universities struggled to protect the ability of their faculties to conduct research seen as offensive, whether by the church, the state, or other powerful influences. Though I will say that the church is the one that started universities in the first place, so give us a little credit. Their success in this regard represents one of the great intellectual triumphs of modern times, one that sits at the foundation of liberal societies. This is why the stakes are high at Brown University. Its leaders must not allow any single politically charged issue, including gender dysphoria, from becoming the thin edge of a wedge that gradually undermines our precious, hard-won academic freedoms. So I took a look at least descriptions of the study and the criticisms of it. And this is important for us to know because the social sciences come up a lot when we're talking about issues like transgender ideology or identity, so-called same-sex marriage, homosexual behavior, well, I should say unnatural sexual behavior, both between men and women, men and men, and women and women, and unnatural sexual behavior with the other 58 genders that are out there. So I don't know how to briefly summarize that. So I was looking, well, I mean, is this study really all that flawed? And there's individuals saying, well, we're not calling for censorship. This isn't censorship. It's critical review of it. Well, okay, but you don't have to pull the press release for the study. You don't have to hide the thing and overreact to the slightest criticism. You wouldn't for other studies criticizing maybe elements of, oh, I don't know, Christian faith or religious upbringing or things like that. No, it's only this one particularly loud, vocal minority who demands that their ideology be accepted or you are banished through some kind of secular excommunication, that you are deemed a secular heretic if you don't accept this ideology and you can't work in the public sphere, you know, can't work in certain jobs or fields. That's what we're coming to. So they're saying, well, no, we're not talking about that kind of censorship. We have valid criticisms of this study. I do think, though, that the criticisms that have been leveled at the Littman study on rapid onset gender dysphoria are ultimately undermine those who accept these lifestyles, who accept the LGBT ideologies. One, the major criticism I found of the Littman study is that she went and did surveys on websites for parents who were concerned about their children developing rapid onset gender dysphoria. A bunch of parents got together online, said, hey, you know, my 15-year-old suddenly thinks that he's a girl and wants sex reassignment surgery. And I don't think any of this is really that bad, but I mean, I don't know if I want my 15-year-old getting this drastic surgery on his or her body, as they describe it. I'm concerned. I want to reach out to other parents. So there's three websites that talk about this: fourthwavenow.com, transgendertrend.com, and youthtranscriticalprofessionals.org. And I went to these websites, and these are transphobic websites. No, I mean, they're skeptical of some transgender claims, but what's the study has shown the parents and the individuals who frequent these sites that I think like 85% of them support so-called same-sex marriage. They generally have a more left or liberal opinion on many of these matters. So these are not websites that were funded by traditional organizations. It's not like their websites funded by, you know, Focus on the Family or Catholic Answers or something like that. Not at all. And so if that's your main criticism, then that undermines many studies that have been used to support LGBT ideology. For example, take same-sex parenting studies. Okay, if you're mad about the Littman study because she used surveys in these websites instead of doing a general representative survey, because look, you're trying to find hidden populations. Warren Throckmorton is a great psychologist, and he wrote about this study and the problem of finding hidden populations. in order to find them, you kind of got to go where they are. And so what's hypocritical about this is that the first same-sex parenting studies, this, for example, the U.S. National Longitudinal Lesbian Family Study, the NILFS study, I guess what it's called, this is considered the gold standard in proving among social scientists that not only are lesbian or gay couples, self-identified lesbian or gay couples, just as good of parents as opposite sex couples. Well, this study is just about lesbian parents because there is really no research, hardly any, a minuscule amount on same-sex fathers, same-sex male couples raising children. You just don't have that. The early reports, though, there are studies that were conducted on same-sex lesbian partners raising children. And the U.S. National Longitudinal Lesbian Family Study is one of them. But guess what? It does the same things as the Littman study. It went out and it actually determined that children raised by two mothers, quote unquote, by two lesbians, do better academically and have less behavioral problems. And it feeds into that myth we have from an anti-father, anti-masculine society that thinks all masculinity is toxic masculinity. This idea that two moms are better than a mom and a dad. If we can get dad out of the picture, moms are superior. We need two moms. And that is just absurd. I'm sorry. Fathers cannot be replaced in this way. And when we devalue fathers, society reaps the bitter fruit of that. If you want a great book that talks about, especially just the relationship between fathers and sons, that is something so hard to replace. A great book my wife and I have read on this subject is called Raising Cain. Raising Cain. We have two sons and, you know, we're trying to figure out, you know, how do you raise these boys in a society that often treats boys as defective girls? You know, at school, boys are loud, rambunctious, want to run around. Why they can't they sit and be quiet like little girls? And so, you know, boys start to have that hard time even early on in life. So the NILF study, the Longitudinal Lesbian Family Study, claimed that, oh yeah, two moms are better than a mom and a dad. But it's mired with problems. The woman who did the study, Nanette Gartrell, she is married to another woman. She has a vested interest in making sure the study reaches a certain conclusion. The volunteers in the study, they all submitted themselves when they were sought out with ads saying, you know, hey, we're making a study to show that two moms can be just as good parents as anyone else, and we want you to take part. And so Gartrell went out and got women from affluent, college-educated women, so wealthier, educated suburbanites, people who live in large cities like I think it was like Boston, Chicago, Washington, D.C., and they submit themselves to the study. Well, guess what? If you and your partner are having a rough time raising your adopted child or whatnot, and you're a lesbian couple, and you feel like your family's not doing well, then you're going to choose to not submit yourself to the study, because you don't want to tamper the results. So when you do studies like this, which are so common among same-sex parenting studies, then you get that kind of a bias. And that's something that you want to look out for, that when you see any kind of study, be sure to dig a little bit deeper into it, especially sociological studies that try to prove things that counteract what we know from good sense and reason. I know the New York Times a few years ago actually published a study showing the study claimed that children, their behavioral and academic outcomes are basically the same regardless of how much time they spend with their parents, which is an asinine study. It's an asinine idea that you're going to prove that with data, empirical data, that, oh, children, it doesn't matter how much time you spend with your kids. Even if you hardly spend time with your kids, they'll basically turn out fine. And then the Times had to apologize, and they wrote another article after that, showing the study was flawed, and they said, look, we were biased at the New York Times to publish this, because guess what? As journalists who work at a prestigious newspaper, we hardly get to spend time with our children, and so we feel guilty about it, and we'll latch on to any study, anything to vindicate what we believe. So I'm not saying here that the Littman study is invalid because of this. I'm not saying that at all. What I'm saying is it's raising an important question about whether transgender ideology, this is not something deep-seated in a person's being. It may be some kind of behavior that's adapted, that's learned from social imitation or social contagion, that it's peers imitating one another. And if that's the case, it's something that they may grow out of. For example, there is an article in The Economist. This was published September 1st. Why are so many teenage girls appearing in gender clinics? A lot of teenage girls go to gender clinics saying, I'm really a man. I want to transition. I want to get these hormone replacements. I want surgery to remove my breasts. And what's interesting, this is an excerpt from it. It talks about a young woman named Rachel and her mother, Jeanette. You know, they fought for months over this. And The Economist, this is what it says, squashing research risks injuring the health of an unknown number of troubled adolescent girls. Rachel, now 21, squashing research, like what we want to do at Brown University, people want to say, oh, this study, we don't even want to let people know about it. Well, when you do that, it risks injuring the health of an unknown number of troubled adolescent girls. Rachel, now 21, believes she latched on to a trans identity as a way of coping with on-off depression and being sexually abused as a child. After receiving therapy, her gender dysphoria disappeared. Had her mother affirmed her gender identity as a 16-year-old, as several gender therapists urged, Rachel would have embarked on a medical transition that she turned out not to want after all. So we should be firm with people to say we should follow truth and evidence. And when people are promoting this ideology that's so at variance with the nature of the human person, to say this is not transphobic, it is not hateful, it is a loving thing to say we do not want you to harm yourself in an irreversible way or your child by embracing this false ideology. And the data is even showing the growing number of people who call themselves detransitioners. They're people who transition thinking that they're really a man, really a woman, then go back to identifying as their biological sex because that wasn't the problem. They had some other condition, some other clinical depression or mental illness they were trying to face. And going down this path can be just so injurious. And that's why we have to show, hey, this may be not what people are talking about. They're not understanding this. And they're putting ideology, they're putting a sexual revolution ideology ahead of the human rights, welfare, and dignity of those who could be harmed by all the processes involved in this. I'll also add that this, you know, detransitioners, transgender, there's another word that comes up here that I've seen online, mostly on Tumblr. I don't understand most of the internet. Tumblr is one of them. I thought that was just something you did to like make your jeans look a certain way. Like it's like stonewashed jeans. I don't know. So Tumblr is a place where a lot of social justice posts, social justice warriors can be found and those who critique them. And one thing there that I have found a lot are people claiming that there are trans trenders. And this fits right on in with the rapid onset gender dysphoria that Littman talks about in the study, that they talk about individuals who claim to be transgender, have not gone through hormone replacement therapy, have not gone through sex reassignment surgery, don't intend to. The one that they really get mad about, that those who identify as transgender or as feminist end up really not liking, are biological, so follow the terms here, biological males who identify as transgender lesbian women. So what that would mean is you have a biological male who says he is a woman who is attracted to other women. I would say, no, you're a man who is naturally attracted to women. And so there are women in the trans, so you'll have these transgender lesbian women trying to have romantic relationships with other lesbian women who are not transgender. And those lesbian women are not interested because our transgender lesbian woman individual still has male genitals. And some of them are not very happy about this. They consider it a kind of discrimination. I talked on Twitter a while back. I watched one of these videos and was just utterly baffled by the kind of Orwellian talk that I saw there. So you've heard of transgender. The other term I will throw in there is trans trender, is a term that is used for these individuals that are taking a transgender label or identity and doing it merely to get attention for themselves. And this is not something I invented. This is not something that transphobic individuals, quote unquote, came up with. You know, it's something that appeared organically within the transgender community to identify those who are partaking of this identity for what they will say are the wrong reasons. So who are they to judge other people's claims to their gender identity? In fact, Urban Dictionary has an entry for this, trans trender. A trans trender is a person who identifies as male or female but does not experience any gender dysphoria. It can also mean someone who identifies as male or female because they think it's trendy or cool, which is what you would expect a high schooler to do and would merit studying rapid onset gender dysphoria like we see in the Littman study. So I hope that was helpful for you to keep in mind as this study gets talked about more in news and media. And it's important for you to keep in mind when you hear other studies, especially those that try to undermine basic truths about the human person through skewed sample sizes. We have to be wary of those, and that's something to look for, especially the fallacy in a study where the participants were all part of a survey and they're kind of cherry-picked instead of finding a representative sample in the population. So I hope that's helpful for you, and I once again want to thank you for being a listener here at the Council of Trent podcast. Do go on iTunes to leave me a review. Those have been really helpful. I've actually scrolled through them recently, and they're very, they warm my heart. Thank you. It's so great to hear that the podcast is helping people, because that's what I want to do. That's why I do this. I do this because I want to help people as much as possible through these difficult issues. And if you'd like more resources, I'm going to release, I have another podcast, bonus content that you'll find at TrenthornPodcast.com if you're a premium subscriber. For just $5 a month, you can get almost all of that content you will find there at TrenthornPodcast.com, including excerpts from homilies that I have found to be very helpful in addressing the scandal and other issues afflicting the church right now. So I'd love to have you become a premium subscriber at TrenthornPodcast.com. Check it out there. And if not, I would still very much enjoy if you listen to the podcast and check back with us in next week. Going to keep trying to give you a lot more episodes. I definitely want to keep putting out more content. So I'm hoping to do Tuesdays and Thursdays from here on out. And who knows, maybe if we get things really streamlined here at Catholic Answers, might have some special content for you on Wednesdays as well, because there is a lot of error, falsehood, a lot of things that people are suffering from out there. And we need the gospel. We need the grace of God to combat it. And my little way of helping, I think, might be through this podcast. So pray for me so that all those good things our Lord has given us can be given back to the world to help those who need it most. So thank you guys. I hope you have a blessed day.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrenthornPodcast.com.